You're listening to MLB.com Extras, brought to you by MLB.tv. It's baseball everywhere.
On this week's tour around the NL Central, the Cardinals catch a huge break on Thursday night and a walk-off win over the Reds. Meanwhile, Cincinnati, Pittsburgh, and Milwaukee look for signs of encouragement as their 2016 campaigns come to a close, and the baseball world continues to reel from the tragic death of Jose Fernandez of the Miami Marlins. We kick things off this week with our Cardinals reporter, Jennifer Langosch. And Jen, this is not the best way to begin any discussion, any podcast, but obviously the baseball world and the sports world are still rocked by the tragic news, which we learned last Sunday morning, of the tragic death of Jose Fernandez of the Miami Marlins. It is still hard to, say or read those words. It's hard to believe that he's gone, such a bright light in the game at the age of 24. I know that, teams all across baseball, including the Cardinals, obviously paid tribute in their own way to Jose Fernandez. And in particular, I know that Aledmys Diaz was a childhood friend of Jose's, and they grew up together. I think Aledmys might be 1 or 2 years older, but nonetheless, very close. And he had a moment that is just ingrained in everybody's minds and will be for some time, as he hit a grand slam a couple of nights ago in tribute to his fallen friend. Just kind of talk about the reaction throughout the clubhouse to the death of Jose Fernandez, and again, in particular, that wonderful tribute from Aledmys Diaz and how his death has really affected him.
Yeah, I mean, this was, when we heard the news last Sunday about the tragic death, I mean, my mind first went to Aledmys Diaz. And as you mentioned, this is a childhood best friend. I mean, they grew up a couple doors down from each other on the same street in the Santa Clara neighborhood of Cuba. Jose Fernandez actually learned baseball from Aledmys Diaz's father and uncle. They were the ones that encouraged his mother to get him into the sport. They grew up together. They played together. Obviously, their careers, their paths diverged for a while as Jose Fernandez came to the States before Aledmys, but eventually they both got here to the United States, and they were able to share some special moments together in the big leagues this year. I mean, first in the National League All-Stars, getting to share that clubhouse together in San Diego. I remember talking to both players at that time and how special it was for them to be teammates, but also what it meant for their little neighborhood back in Cuba. And then a few weeks after that, they were actually able to face each other for the first time as major leaguers. Aledmys Diaz got the better end of that matchup, actually hitting a two-run homer and an RBI double off of Jose Fernandez that day. And when they talked about it afterwards, Jose told Aledmys, "Next time I face you, I'm going to strike you out twice." And now it's jarring to think that there isn't going to be a next time. So, it's been a tough week for Aledmys Diaz. He left the team on Monday to go be with the Fernandez family, spent the day down there in Miami, came back to St. Louis and played for the first time on Tuesday. And as you mentioned, a moment that I think all of us who watched play out had goosebumps as we watched. I mean, we saw what happened with Dee Gordon hitting that home run in Miami on Monday night on such an emotional night for that team. It was very similar here in St. Louis as Aledmys Diaz hit his first career grand slam, one of the biggest hits of the season for the Cardinals, given where they are in this postseason race, but then also personally just with the weight of all this on his shoulders. And then as he came across home plate, looking up to the sky, tipping his cap to the sky when he got a curtain call. And just an emotional night for a young kid who has been through so much this year already, and will continue to pay tribute with the Jose Fernandez initials on his cap, and certainly going through a lot grieving as he's still trying to stay competitive on the field as well.
Yeah, not an easy thing for sure. And you mentioned that he is one of many players with the JF16 on the ball cap, and you brought up the home run by Dee Gordon. The leadoff homer is first of the year, and then the tears visible as he crossed home plate, pointing up to the sky, a scene very similar to what we saw in St. Louis with Aledmys Diaz. So very tough week for him, a very tough week for baseball in general, as, again, everybody's still reeling from this just unbelievably tragic news of the passing of Jose Fernandez almost 1 week ago now. Jennifer, getting back to the business on the field, Thursday night's walk-off win did not come without some controversy, certainly. They beat the Reds 4-3, but the real entertainment, if you will, kind of occurred after the game-winning hit by Yadier Molina. That's when Reds manager Brian Price basically literally chasing the umpires kind of down the rabbit hole, trying to get their attention and issue a challenge. A challenge never was issued, even though, as you wrote in the post-game wrap-up, the ball that Molina hit should have been called a ground rule double. It was not. It allowed Matt Carpenter to score from first base. He should have been stopped at third. So kind of break down this whole thing for us. First of all, why was that ball, which did not reach the seats, why should that have been a ground rule double, and why was the challenge not issued when Brian Price really had nothing to lose by, you know, saying something after the game? Instead, he waited, then he waited too long, and the Cardinals walk off with a win that's, you know, technically they should not have had.
Yeah, I'll try to break down the chaos that we saw play out there. It was so weird to see the Cardinals celebrating a walk-off and the Reds kind of players just lingering on the field thinking that they were going to get to throw another pitch. But as it happened, you know, the umpires on the field missed the fact that when the ball hit the warning track, it actually bounced up and hit kind of a signage of advertisements beyond the left field wall, which a ball that hits that area is out of play, and as you noted, should have been ruled a ground rule double. That was missed at the time. Yadi gets, you know, he gets his hit. Matt Carpenter scores the run. The problem then became how long Brian Price waited to go after the umpiring crew. After the game, crew chief Phil Miller said he waited on the field for about 10 seconds, gave Brian Price the opportunity to challenge the call, which a call that ends the game must be challenged immediately by rule, in order for replay review to be enlisted. So that didn't happen. The umpires then exited the field, as you noted. Brian Price went chasing them, and when he finally caught up with them, was told, quite frankly, you didn't do this quickly enough. And you know, and the chaos on the Red side through all of this is that as this was happening, their video coordinator back in the clubhouse was reviewing the play. They saw immediately that this should be a ground rule double. They phoned the dugout, but because of the crowd noise, because of the fireworks, nobody in the Reds dugout heard the phone ring. It took a Reds employee running up the tunnel to get Brian Price's attention to tell him that he needed to challenge that call. And again, by the time he alerted the umpires, he was too late in doing so. So, of course, in all of this, the implication is what it means for a very tight wild card race. And you have a team out in San Francisco, and you have the New York Mets there, you know, trying to bury the Cardinals. And here St. Louis was getting a walk-off hit on what should have been a hit that continued the game. So there's really no recourse right now for the Reds to do anything. They could file a protest, but it would likely be denied since this wasn't a misapplication of rules. It was just, quite frankly, a missed call. So probably a way we'll never see the game end again. Probably a kind of a reminder to managers that anything that looks amiss at the end of the game, there's no hurt in just going ahead and challenging it immediately. I would certainly think that Brian Price moving forward has learned his lesson and would do that if this happened again.
I was going to bring up that exact point, that if you're Brian Price, you have nothing to lose. You've already lost the game. Why wait? Why wait for a phone to ring? Why wait for somebody to get into your ear? Hey, that should not, you know, that should be a ground rule double. Get out there, challenge the call immediately. Again, you literally have nothing to lose. He didn't do that. It cost the Reds, I won't say it cost them a win because they might have lost the game anyway, but it cost them a chance to at least prolong the game, as the Cardinals would have had runners at second and third, two outs, instead walk-off double. And, you know, Jen, you brought up the Giants and Mets, part of this three-team equation for the two wild-card spots in the NL, and a lot of fans in those markets not happy with the way that the game ended last night in St. Louis. And I know that, you know, players and managers preach all the time, you know what, take care of your own business. Don't pay attention to what other teams are doing. Let the chips fall where they may. But how much of a reality is that, especially right now, considering how tight this race is? The Cardinals still on the outside looking in. Is there a lot of scoreboard watching going on? Is there a lot of paying attention to what the Mets and Giants are doing? Or is this a team that really is saying, okay, you know, we don't care what they're doing. As long as we win, things are going to work out in our favor.
There is a lot of scoreboard watching, you know, at least from the Cardinal side. I can speak of, you know, from those that I've spoken to within this organization, and that's because regardless of if they win out, they actually do need some help. So, I mean, they need the Giants to lose at least one game, and that would be, again, if St. Louis sweeps the series against Pittsburgh. So they need some help. They put themselves in a position where they do not control their own destiny in this wild card race. You know, when you talk to players, when you talk to manager Mike Matheny, they talk a lot about trying to, during a game, not look up at that scoreboard all that often. But after games, we see that the games on in the clubhouse, whether it's the Giants game or if the Mets are still playing, we see those games being played. Players are connected to it. I think Mike Matheny has kind of the right mindset when he explains to his team you know, embrace this opportunity as well. There are a lot of players that go through their major league career and never have the opportunity to be in a pennant chase this late into September. So enjoy it, but also know that you have to take care of business on the field. So, yeah, there's a lot of eyes on what's going on. The scoreboard is hard to miss. It's huge out there, right field in Busch Stadium. And so the Cardinals will, of course, this weekend be paying very close attention to what's going on in the San Francisco and New York game.
You know, not a place you ever want to start a discussion or a podcast especially, but we have to bring up the tragic passing of Miami Marlins ace Jose Fernandez, who was, you know, we all awoke to the news Sunday morning that he was killed in a boating accident off the shores of Miami, and it just rocked the baseball world and continues to do so. Considering his stature in the game and the limitless potential that he had, it's all gone now at the age of 24, which is just unbelievable. But, Adam, kind of talk about the reaction to Fernandez's passing within the Pirates clubhouse, and if any players in particular on the Pirates team had any sort of a special connection to Jose Fernandez.
Yeah, not a lot of the Pirates players, you know, knew him very personally. Obviously, they all knew of him, had faced him. Some guys coming up through the minor leagues, you know, obviously a lot of guys in the majors. There were a few guys who spent just a little bit of time with the Marlins, and they, you know, said the kind of stuff that we all have really been able to see from the outside about Fernandez, is that he was, you know, such a magnetic personality, so energetic, you know, just such a joy to be around. And, you know, I can say personally, such a joy to watch. He was a lot of things about baseball that we all kind of want to try to create. He was just that organically, you know. He was passionate, enthusiastic. He just had a lot of fun. And I think, you know, in addition to just kind of that otherworldly talent, that was what made him so special and sort of made this, you know, such a tough time for the whole baseball family. Clint Hurdle, the Pirates manager, didn't really know him that well, but he spent quite a bit of time with him on the award circuit in 2013 when Jose Fernandez was the National League Rookie of the Year. Clint Hurdle was manager of the year. Hurdle told us, you know, just sort of about that interaction. They got, you know, just spent a little bit of time together at that time. But then every time that Hurdle would see Fernandez after that, you know, Jose would come running up to him, say, you know, "Hey, Poppy, how you doing, man?" Like they'd been friends forever, which was, I guess, kind of the way that he treated everyone. And then Hurdle actually, you know, in light of that news, shared some words that I think kind of resonated throughout baseball. You know, Clint's been through a lot. He's, you know, very serious, very motivational, takes, you know, a lot of stock in sort of the human condition, not just baseball. And one of the things he said that I know resonated with other players, coaches, people throughout baseball, sports, and really just, you know, people dealing with tragedy. He said, this is a quote from him, "It just makes all the more sense when things like this happen to be where your feet are, enjoy the moment, and remember there'll be a day where there won't be another day." I think that was pretty powerful stuff from Clint Hurdle in the wake of just a really awful, awful tragedy.
Yeah, it really is. And I mean, again, just seeing whether you saw the news on TV or you got a text message or however you came across the news, I mean, it just rocks you to your core. It's bad when it happens, period, when it happens to somebody, as you said, as magnetic and, you know, effervescent as Jose Fernandez was. It just it really shakes you, and just terrible, terrible news here at the end of the regular season with the passing of Jose Fernandez, but some very illuminating words by Clint Hurdle there regarding, you know, life in general, and it's great that he got to know Jose back in 2013, and like you said, that kind of exemplifies who Jose was. You know, he treated Clint Hurdle like he was a long-lost best friend after that, after being on the award circuit 3 years ago. So, terrible, terrible loss for baseball, certainly with the passing of Jose Fernandez. Adam, getting back to the business at hand with the on-field goings-on, and we saw something last night at PNC Park that we had not seen in baseball in over 11 years, and that was a tie game. The Pirates and Cubs wrapping up at 1-1, and personally, I'm a little disappointed that we're not going to get to see the dash one on the one loss record, if you will, for both the Pirates and the Cubs, because Major League Baseball, despite declaring this a tie game, that game is not going to be reflected in the one loss record. So it's as if it never happened. And again, I'm a little disappointed by this because I want to see that dash one, because it's so rare that you would ever see that for any baseball team to go back to the, whatever, the 10s, the 20s, the 1900s. There are a couple of those there, but what about you? Do you think that the dash one should be there for both teams?
Well, it's funny. A lot of my hockey writer friends in Pittsburgh, which obviously is just such a hockey-centric town, were really just baffled by this. Don't count. It's such like a central part of hockey.
Right.
Records and everything. It's just so bizarre to explain. You know, it was a 162-game season with 162 games worth of stats, but 161 games worth of wins and losses. It really is such a bizarre thing. So, yeah, you kind of do want that dash. Plus, I like the idea, which is possible heading into this final weekend of the season, that the Pirates could finish with an 81-win winning season. That would just be such kind of a bizarre thing to look at, and maybe in a couple of ways of appropriate and fitting of this season. But, I mean, yeah, players were even a little surprised by it. It's been 11 years since there was a tie. The last one was in June 2005. So some guys were legitimately surprised that, you know, a game could end in a tie. And as they described it, pardon the pun, it was sort of the perfect storm of events where the game didn't count in the standings. It's at the end of the year. There would be no time to make it up. The Cubs have already clinched everything. The Pirates are already out of the playoffs. So, yeah, Major League Baseball intervened, and it's a tie that we'll never speak of in the standings again.
It's just so odd. I remember, you know, being at work last night and being told, okay, you know, this game counts and we're going to have highlights and the numbers count, but it's not going to be reflected in the one-loss standings. I'm thinking, well, that can't be right. But, no, that's the way it is, and I'm sure it's not going to be very high on Rob Manfred's offseason to-do list. But, hey, Commish, right. let's fix this, because I'd love to see the Pirates potentially finish, as you said, 81-80-1, which would be probably the coolest record in baseball history. Unfortunately, that's not going to happen. And, Adam, I found it, in a disappointing way, rather ironic that the final home game of the season cut short due to rainfall, and that's how the Pirates fans depart BNC for another season as they await opening day now in 2017 in April. And, you know, whenever a team misses the playoffs as a fan base, you kind of take stock in the state of the team. It's either, okay, we're not a playoff team, but we're young, we're up and coming, and we're getting better, or it's we're not a playoff team, we're stagnating, or we're getting worse. So considering that this is the first time in 4 years that the Pirates are not going to be as part of the postseason picture, what is the pulse and the tempo of the fans right now? How do they feel about the direction of this Pirates franchise? Again, as I said, after missing the playoffs for the first time since 2012.
Yeah, I mean, really disappointed in general, just because of where the team was coming from. To go from a 98-win team to potentially, you know, somewhere in the 78 to 81-win team is just, pretty serious fall. And it happened in, you know, kind of a concerning manner with the way that the pitching staff really fell apart, wasn't put together all that well at the beginning of the season, and just the dramatic drop-off from some of the star performers like Andrew McCutchen and Gerrit Cole. And then, you know, then some of the trades, I think, shook some fans' confidence. You know, the trading Mark Melancon when the team was still theoretically in the postseason race, and then trading Francisco Liriano and a couple of prospects for a young arm in Drew Hutchison, who we really haven't seen much of in September. So I think a lot of it is going to depend on how the Pirates kind of go about their business this offseason to sort of restore some faith, in the franchise, because they have some pretty obvious needs, particularly on their pitching staff. And if they're willing to maybe make some of the commitments that they didn't last offseason with a guy like Jay Happ, you know, if they could maybe rectify that with Ivan Nova this offseason, I think that would go a long way toward, restoring some faith and getting a little bit more interest instead of just saying, well, you know, we just hope to compete once again next year. I think fans would really like to see a push, since this core is pretty solid. If everyone plays up to their potential, I think fans would like to see them really, sort of.
Adam, as always, thank you for the time. And unfortunately, this week we have to start things on a down note as the baseball world still rocked by the horrific news we found out early Sunday, the passing of Jose Fernandez of the Miami Marlins at the age of 24, a boating accident off the shores of Miami. And like I said, this is still news that is resonating throughout not just the baseball world, but the sports world in general. Such a bright star with a limitless future, and taken away from all of us. Again, he passes at the age of 24. And Adam, I was just wondering, we saw so many reactions from so many teams across baseball to the passing of Jose Fernandez, and I'm sure the Brewers were no different. Talk about some of the reaction from inside that clubhouse, and if any you know, players or coaches or personnel within the franchise had any sort of special connection with Jose Fernandez.
Yeah, you know, what stood out to me, and I wrote this, is there were no former teammates of Jose Fernandez on this Brewers team, and they faced him only one time in his entire career. It was earlier this year. We always missed him when he was hurt or he just didn't happen to pitch in the series. So there was not a close connection, but I'll tell you, it was as somber a clubhouse as I've ever been in. It really hit players hard that a huge, larger-than-life personality like that could just be taken away. And I think it has, you know, players, you kind of think about your own mortality in those situations. So it was a very, very difficult day. And as far as personal connections, there weren't any former teammates, but I did learn that Jonathan Villar, the Brewers infielder, says he became friends with Jose Fernandez just as spring training rivals when VR was playing with Houston, and they were both in Florida. And he said they would text back and forth, and it was probably about a month ago that he got the last text, and he said Fernandez always encouraged him to, you know, go for it, to be just the player he was. He's an aggressive VR is kind of an aggressive player himself, smiles a lot on the field, and he says Fernandez always encouraged him to keep doing those things. So it was, you know, it's really, really sad for all the players.
Yeah, it's just, it's unbelievable whether you say the words or read the words or hear the words that Jose Fernandez has died. It just seems like it can't be. Like this is some sick, cruel joke, and he's going to pop out of somewhere and say, hey, I got you all. But, you know, that's obviously not going to happen. And the one thing that struck me, among the many tributes and remembrances of Jose Fernandez, was Pedro Martinez on MLB Network. He came right out and said, you know, this kid had more talent and more potential than I did. That's coming from, you know, Pedro freaking Martinez. For him to shower that kind of praise on Jose Fernandez, it just makes you wonder and speculate what he could have been. He was incredible for the time that he was here, but taken away from us way too soon. And just
I'll tell you, Matt, if I can just share one more thing.
Sure.
Craig Counsell called him a Hall of Fame talent.
Wow.
That's what he thought of just the ability that Jose Fernandez had. So they saw some very big things. Just, again, he saw him pitch once live. Mm-hmm. And that's the type of talent that he thought he was. And this is coming from a guy, Craig Counsell, who does not just throw praise out there, you know, even his own players like that. And that really stood out. Craig Counsell had some really powerful comments about this, just basically that what he'll always remember was the word joy. That's the word he associates with Jose. And he said it was, you know, if you can take something from this terrible thing, it's just play the game with joy and accept the joy that this game can give to you.
I agree. And I think that, you know, who knows what the future holds, but, you know, we see so many, you know, I don't know what to call it, unwritten rules about baseball. Guys get so uptight about perceived slights and about, you know, you can do this, you can't do that. Well, here's a guy in Jose Fernandez who, like you said, went out there with a smile on his face 24/7, played the game with exuberance and joy and fun. And we need more of that in baseball. And if that's the legacy he leaves behind, where, you know, players can kind of turn a page and just treat this game for what it is. It's, you know, it is something fun. Yes, it's competitive. Yes, there are big stakes. But at the end of the day, it's a game. That's how he treated it. And, you know, again, if that's the legacy that he leaves, then the game will be better for it. But it's tragic it had to come to this, where he's taken from us at the age of 24. So, Adam, good stuff there with remembrances from some of the Brewers personnel about Jose Fernandez. And getting back to the matters on the field, the Brewers just wrapped up a three-game series in Texas, dropping 2-3. And a lot of old faces, a lot of old friends in that Ranger clubhouse these days, including Carlos Gomez, who spent six seasons in Milwaukee, and most recently Jeremy Jeffress and Jonathan Lucroy, who were part of trade deadline deals just this past, or this current season, I should say. You were in Texas. I'm assuming you got a chance to catch up with one, if not all three of these guys. And what do they have to say about their new situation, you know, playing on a Ranger team that is on their way to being the top seed in the American League playoffs?
Well, yeah, they're obviously having fun. And Carlos Gomez killed the Brewers. He hit a big homer in two of the games, hit a winning homer in the finale. The Brewers could have won that series. They could have swept the series. That would have been quite a thing from a team, as you said, going for the top seed in the playoffs. But it was weird being in there and seeing them in a different uniform. You're used to the fans in Milwaukee, used to seeing them in navy blue, and now you see the royal blue. Lucroy was kind of all business, but Gomez was really fun and reflective about his time in Milwaukee and kind of where his career has gone since then, a really bad experience in Houston. And he says his season kind of started over when he got to the Rangers. And it shows in the production he's given him. He says one of the things that helped him kind of find himself again was walking in the clubhouse door and seeing all those familiar faces. There's the players you mentioned, but there's also Prince Fielder, who's not able to play, unfortunately, but he's been around the team here and there. He wasn't there this week, which was a bummer. It would have been nice to catch up with him at the end of his playing career. But he'll be there with him in the playoffs. And Gomez said there was just a feeling of comfort when he walked in the clubhouse doors and saw all those familiar guys. I'll share one thing. The funniest thing that he said was, I was asking him, it's almost 5 years since he scored the winning run that put the Brewers past the Diamondbacks in the 2011 division series, put him into the NLCS. And I was asking him about that and about Niger Morgan, the guy who got the hit. And Gomez was saying, you know, Niger was the kind of player that if you were on the other team, you hated him. But when he's on your team, he's exuberant. He brings energy. You know, you love the guy. And I looked at Gomez. I said, Gomez, does that remind you of anybody? And he just smiles. He says, who, me? So I think, you know, he's a guy who can laugh at himself a little bit. He gets very emotional at times, and right now he's channeling it all in the right direction for the Rangers.
Yeah, he certainly is, and this is a guy that had struggled so bad with the Astros in the first part of the season that the Astros cut bait with him completely. He gets a new lease on life with the other team in the Lone Star State, and he has looked like his old self. As you said, probably the biggest reason why the Brewers only took one of those three games, as he absolutely crushed a pair of three-run homers in back-to-back games. And those things still might be in orbit. He was sensational, and great to see him and Jeffress and Lucroy down there in Texas for you, no doubt. Now, another guy I want to focus on who is still a Milwaukee Brewer and hopefully will be for some time, Jonathan Villar. And something I didn't realize is that he is one homer shy of a 20-60 campaign. That would be 20 home runs, 60 stolen bases, and only three other players in baseball history have achieved that mark. Some nobodies named Ricky Henderson, Joe Morgan, and Eric Davis for the Reds back in the mid-80s. So three very prominent names there, two Hall of Famers. In your discussion with Jonathan Villar, how badly does he want to get that next home run, number 20, to put him in that very exclusive club?
Well, he insists to me that the key is not thinking about it, because the number he really wanted was 60. And he's talked about that one for actually a couple of weeks. That has been a goal of his. And you saw in the first, you know, 2 or 3 weeks of September, him fall into a really deep slump. And he was pushing because he was just trying to get on base to get those stolen bases. So he says when he stopped kind of pressing, he figured out a way to kind of clear his mind a little bit. That's when the hits started to come, and now the extra base hits have really come in bunches. He hit two homers in one of the games in Texas, then hit another homer in the finale to put him to the edge. So he insists he's going up there trying not to think about it. Now, you know, is that true? I don't. With three games at Coors Field, you're not thinking about hitting a homer. I think he's going to have to fight that in these this three-game series. But it's quite an achievement. I was surprised when I looked, and it's been since 1990. Henderson in 90 was the last 2060 guy. It just seems like those aren't out of this world. They're certainly great numbers, but I thought there'd be another player who got it. I was kind of surprised that it's been that long.
Yeah, me too. We're talking over a quarter century now, and for him to get that 20th homer and join that club would be big for him. And I'm with you that, you know, if you're playing at Coors Field and you're one homer shy of achieving this feat, there is no way that your brain is not honed in on getting that home run, especially considering the environment. Coors Field in Denver, great place for him to hopefully launch homer number 20. We'll see what the next three games bring as the Brewers close out the season. And Adam, in all your years covering this team, have you seen a player have as unexpected a great season as Jonathan Villar is having for Milwaukee in 2016?
Well, I'd have to think about that. I mean, I think Junior Guerra, their pitcher, comes to mind for me. But you know, when you're talking about doing something that hasn't been done in 26 years, that is pretty amazing. When they traded for him, it was a minor trade. It was David Stern's first trade, by the way. It looked like they were getting a guy to be like a utility infielder. Gene Segura was still the shortstop at that time. And it just looked like VR was going to do what he did in Houston, kind of play all over, get at bats when he can, switch hitter, some speed. You didn't see him as really even an everyday guy. Then that changed when they traded Segura. Then he looked like he was just going to be a bridge at shortstop to Orlando Arcia, their top prospect. And VR has played himself into much more than that. So now they have to figure out, well, where do we play him? He's got to play somewhere. I'm not in the camp that believes the Brewers will look to trade him this winter when his value is so high. He's got so much club control left. He's a young player. He's exactly the kind of player that you're looking to acquire. And I don't see them trading him. So, you know, it's basically second or third base because Arcia is up now. He's the shortstop. He's going to be the shortstop on opening day. And where does VR fit best? He's been okay at third. He's made some errors over there. But, you know, it's a guy learning a different – after being up the middle basically at shortstop for most of his life, it was playing the hot corner is just proving a challenge. So that's a possibility. But, you know, I think second base, he'd look pretty good there. It's another up the middle, a little easier transition. He'd be a heck of a double play team up the middle with Arcia. And the Brewers then would have to figure out what they're going to do at third base. They'd also have to figure out what they're going to do with Scooter Gennett, who's been the third baseman for basically the last three-plus years. Or, I'm sorry, the second baseman for the last three-plus years and can only play second base. They probably would look to trade him. So there's some questions, I think, this offseason about how they're going to make that work. But the bottom line is it took a huge step. And when you talk to the coaches and teammates, they see a guy who's got a more in him. Because of the dramatic improvement he's made this year and the talent, just the raw talent that he has, they sort of think that this is a guy who could take another step. You know, Council's talking to him about 30 homers. They think that there's that sort of ability there. That would be pretty amazing for a switch hitter.
Mark, this is not a place you ever want to start a discussion or a podcast especially, but the tragic death of Jose Fernandez, which we found out about in the early morning hours of Sunday, still very fresh on the minds of many people within baseball and the sports world throughout. And, such a tragic loss, obviously, that goes without saying. But, Mark, from the Reds' perspective, talk about reaction to the passing of Fernandez within that clubhouse and if any players or even coaches or managers in particular had any sort of a connection or were close in any way to Jose Fernandez, who, again, his life was tragically cut short at the age of 24.
Yeah, I mean, the clubhouse was sad. It was walking in there on Sunday morning. You definitely saw people watching on television, and a couple of people struck me as somewhat connected. Anthony DeSclafani was a Marlin. He broke in with the Marlins, and actually his major league debut was to replace Fernandez in the rotation when he had to have Tommy John surgery. So he knew him, and he didn't know them really well because he was injured the whole time he was with the Marlins, but he said he spent a lot of time in and out of the clubhouse offering encouragement, was always kind to him, and he always appreciated that, and he definitely sensed how much he loved baseball and how much the community loved him. So it was very hard for DeSclafani. You could definitely tell he was emotional about it. He's also a young guy, so it certainly hits him in that way as well. And in a different sort of way, Ted Power, the Reds bullpen coach, never met him. But he was involved in a very similar scenario in 1993. He was a member of the Cleveland Indians and was scheduled to be on a fishing trip with Steve Olin, Tim Cruz, and Bob Ojeda on a lake on their one-off day, and decided kind of at the last minute not to take the trip with those guys. He felt like it was his one-off day. He'd rather be home with his family and at their rented spring training home. So he stuck it out in Winter Haven. All the other three went out, and of course, on that horrible day, Steve Olin and Tim Cruz were killed when their boat hit a dock, and Ojeda was seriously injured, and it was a crusher, of course, for the Indians and for Cleveland and for all the families, of course. And, Ted Power said his story wasn't important, but he could certainly remember that horrible day immediately. It kind of came flooding back to him, and he knows exactly what the Marlins are going through because the Indians went through it that year, and it was a really rough time for everybody.
Yeah, it still is a rough time for the baseball world at large with the passing of Jose Fernandez, and we've heard from at least one or two players on the Marlins who said that they received invites from Jose and the other two men who also tragically lost their lives that day about joining them on the boats for whatever reasons they declined, and that's something that sticks with you for the rest of your life. And unfortunately, Jose Fernandez taken from us at the age of 24, and it certainly rocked the baseball world. And as you said, in particular, guys like Ted Powers and Anthony DeSclafani, who began his career as a Miami Marlin. Mark, to transition from that to a wild walk-off loss last night, Thursday night in St. Louis, kind of a surreal scene after the game. We see, you know, the Cardinals celebrating a walk-off win on a Yadier Molina double. We see the Reds players lingering just outside the dugouts and on the field, wondering, well, wait a minute, that should have been a ground rule double. The run should not have scored. We see Brian Price trying to chase down the umpires as they had left the field. Kind of a very weird cartoonish scene. So kind of break this whole thing down for us, as it was determined after the fact that that ball that Molina hit should have been ruled a ground rule double. It was not, allowing Matt Carpenter to score all the way from first base, in which case he would have been sent back to third. But explain why a challenge was not immediately issued, and why that when Brian Price decided he did want a challenge, he was not allowed to.
Well, a whole lot of things went wrong, honestly, on everybody's point, with the umpires, with the rules, with the Reds, quite frankly. The bottom line was, is Adam Duvall, he saw the ball hit the sign. He didn't know that the sign was behind the fence. He thought the sign was in play, but he also knew enough that could be the last play of the game, so he did not want to stop the play and risk losing the game right there. So he played it out and was hoping that that would get figured out later. Brian Price and the rest of the Reds are in the dugout. The way is the angle is, they're down, they're in the ground, the kind of left field where the cutout is. You can't really see it that well. They didn't have a great angle. They didn't know. Obviously, Matt Carpenter scores, and it's loud. Crowd is cheering. Fireworks are going off inside the clubhouse where the video monitors are, where the video guys are sitting. They're trying to call the dugout. The dugout phone's ringing. No one can hear it with all the noise. So the Reds aren't getting the word that they need to challenge. By the time somebody from the clubhouse runs down and tells Brian Price, he's looking for the umpires who have already walked off the field. And you can kind of see on the replay, the umpires are kind of looking into the dugout saying, maybe you guys want to, challenge us? I don't know. And it's a weird rule. It's like, okay, the rule is apparently they were told it was 10 seconds, but it turns out they had to make the immediate decision. They had no way of knowing whether there was an immediate need to stop the proceedings and have a look. And, the umpires kind of like, well, if you didn't challenge, it's too bad. But they kind of put the getting the play right on the secondary back burner. I thought that was kind of weird. Kind of put the onus on the aggrieved party, which is a weird thing. So now it's kind of, you got some people blaming the Reds for not doing their job, but it's really easy to second guess. But when it's happening in the moment, I can see why they didn't know to replay. Why would you think a ball went off the wall? When I saw it with my naked eye the first time, I thought it hit the wall cleanly, like as it was in play. And then only when I saw the replay did I know. And I have the advantage of being behind home plate. So it was a mess, and Brian Price went and talked to the umpires, but it was too late, and the team's not going to protest because they feel like as far as I know, they're not going to protest still. They follow the letter of the law, but obviously the rule kind of had a loophole.
Yeah, I agree with you that the onus should not be on the, as you said, the aggrieved party, which is in this case the Reds, certainly, as they're staring at a walk-off loss. I guess my question is, if there's even a shred of doubt in your mind, if you're Brian Price, if there's even just one iota of doubt that, you know what do I have to lose at this point? I'm going to run out there. I'm going to issue a challenge. Maybe I look completely foolish, but, hey, what's the worst that could happen? The worst that could happen is, we have a walk-off loss right now, and it's still going to be a walk-off loss. They can't get any worse. So, again, I guess that's my question. If you're Brian Price, again, what do you have to lose at that point rather than trying to sit there and determine, well, should I or shouldn't I?
He didn't know, though. The point is he thought it was a run-of-the-mill ground rule double. He had no reason to think, okay, he's watching the ball as best as he can from down in a dugout under the ground looking out to left field. He has no way of thinking, well, gee, I should challenge this. But just to throw a challenge out for the sake of the challenge isn't really what's been done in baseball. No one else that I know of has done that. He had no reason to think that it wasn't a clean hit. The first moment he found out about it was when someone came from the clubhouse and notified him. So he didn't really feel like he had enough time to get that information and relay it to the umpires. Once he did, he ran out of the dugout in a desperate move to try to check him down. But I don't think he thought there was anything hinky going on with that play at first glance.
Now, Mark, going back, you mentioned Adam Duvall. Now, he's the left fielder on this play. And you might have covered this already, and I might have missed it. But as he is fielding that ball, does he immediately think this is definitely a ground rule double, or was he unsure and that's why the play continued as it did, rather than put his hands up and say, hey, you know, that ball's out of play? What was his first reaction when he saw the trajectory of that ball and where it ended up?
His first reaction was the ball was in play only because he knew it hit the sign, but he kind of pleaded a little ignorance to the ground rule. He didn't realize the sign was behind the fence that was in play. He thought it was in play. So I asked him, why didn't you throw your arms up? And he said, well, at the time I knew it hit the sign, but I thought the sign was in play. But if I had any, you know, he's like, I couldn't stop. I had to, you know, do everything I could to field the ball and get it in. Otherwise we would have lost the game for sure. So I get that point of view, but I also think that it's up to the outfielder and the team to know the ground rules to a T. And that's one of those situations. They got to say, hey, listen, he needs to know that a little bit. I was a little surprised that he said he didn't realize that part of the fence was not in play. And, you know, the Reds have been there now 3 series this year. I know he's a relatively new left fielder, but I think that's one area where I did have a problem with. I thought maybe he should know the rules there, and he didn't.
Yeah, and it ultimately, you know, cost the Reds. And again, technically, you know, the Cardinals got a huge break. They win the game on a walk-off, which should not have been a walk-off. Instead, it should have been second and third, two outs. Maybe the Reds get out of that inning. Maybe the Reds win the game. And maybe that puts a coffin in the Cardinal, or that puts a nail in the coffin of the Cardinals' postseason hopes. You know, we'll see how it all plays out. But a little surprised that the Reds are not going to protest the game. They decided they'll take their medicine and they'll walk away with a loss. But if the Cardinals do qualify as a wild card and end up winning the wild card game and progressing as far as they want to in the postseason, a lot of people are going to look back at that game and say, boy, what a huge breakup for St. Louis. So a very interesting game last night for the Reds and for the Cardinals both. And tough night as well, Mark, for Joey Votto, as he took multiple stitches to the chin after he was struck by a ball on a throw from the outfield. I'm actually a little surprised this doesn't happen more often in the game, but I know that, again, a lot of blood on the field at the time he left the game. How's he feeling today?
Well, I haven't seen him yet today, but last night I saw him, and he was fine. He had a tape and bandage over his chin. Said he never, you know, had any trouble. There was no concussion issue. It was just a cut, and really he wanted to stay in the game and kind of go hockey style and get patched up right there and then, but there was too much blood. They were not able to, under the, you know, the kind of the rules of the game, you can't stop the game indefinitely to patch him up at second base. They had to bring him in, do it the right way, and the only way he could do that was to come out of the game. So if it was up to him, he would have stayed, but in order to patch him up, he had to go back to the clubhouse in the training room to get the stitches. He got 7 stitches. I would anticipate he'll be in the lineup today, but he was, you know, just talking to him last night, he was fine.
I think we've got even better too this offseason. I don't know how many wins or what we're all going to do individually, but I think we set ourselves up pretty good.
This has been a good feeling throughout camp. The players really feel connected with one another. They're all here for the right reason. They feel like they have a special opportunity to go on this journey together and prove something.
The word pressure to me is a positive word. If in fact we are the hunted, let's go. I want our guys to be ready and understand we can't take anything for granted. You got to go out there and prove it on the field.
Cranks this one out into deep left center. Schwarber, Fowler, and neither can catch it. I hope they're all right. The biggest concern right now for the Cubs is Kyle Schwarber.
We're just concerned about him. We'll figure out a way to survive this whole moment. We're going to be there for him mentally to talk to whatever he needs. But he will kill the rehab. I'm certain of that.
Swing and a miss. 3 outs away.
Everyone's palms sweating a little bit. Arrieta 1 out away from making history here at the Great American Ballpark. A fly ball, shallow right, coming in is Hayward. No hitter for Arrieta.
Jake Arrieta has done it again.
Doing this for David Ross, you know, this is the first time he's been able to catch a no hitter. Being able to do that for him and hopefully get him another ring is something we're looking forward to doing.
Sitting on 99 career home runs. And he drives out in the left, number 100.
Ross is the boss, indeed. Grandpa Rossi with number 100. Going to walk the gauntlet before stepping out. Tip the hat.
Deep left center. Game over. Cubs win. Baez does it. 4-3 the final.
It's been impressive to watch. The pitching has been outstanding. Obviously, they're scoring a ton of runs. Defensively, they've been solid. And that's how you get to 21-6. You do everything.
Right field, is it going to stay fair? You bet it will. Two will score. 8 in a row now as they hang on and beat the Pods 8-7.
This team could be even better with Wilson Contreras playing every day. They have not gotten a lot of production out of catcher, and maybe he has an increased role later in the season.
A goosebump kind of moment here before his first ever big league at bat.
High and deep to center field, and it is gone!
First swing in the big leagues, and he launches a two-run homer. Right, lines one to third, pass to diving Suarez down the left field line.
It will go! 2-for-2.
Give me that read again, Andre. 4,972 feet.
Since 1913, he is the first player ever to do this. 3 homers and 2 doubles.
You know, I'll cherish this game for a long time. Definitely one of those games that you don't ever forget.
Aroldis Chapman has been acquired in a 4-for-1 deal from the New York Yankees.
I think this is the final piece of the puzzle for a very complete Cub team.
He's a dynamic pitcher. He's an impact guy, and he fits really well into our club. And this was a show of faith in our big league team. It was an aggressive move. It was tough to give up what we gave up, but if not now, when?
Kick and the pitch. Called strike 3. 104 freezes Davis. Cubs win. Cubs sweep.
The Cubs have won 9 in a row. They climb 30 games above 500.
The pitch. Ball 4. Cubs win. That's 10 in a row.
Get out the tape measure from Matt Caesar.
Soler hustles out of the left center.
Caesar hits another one. Cubs have won 11 in a row. So many positive things for the Cubs. I don't even know where to start.
Along the right field line. And Rizzo on the ledge. He's got it. Oh, what a play.
All the bobblehead company. We got the tarp catch. Now we got the ledge catch.
Coming in, Caesar on the run. Going out, Russell. A fabulous diving catch.
Unbelievable.
Racing over to the left field line. An impossible play by Addison Russell.
Ladled out toward left center. It's going to drop Rizzo around third. He will score. The Jason Heyward game ends in 13.
We all been grinding. I've been grinding. But it doesn't matter, man. You know what? We're trying to all do it. One play at a time, one game at a time. And I just contributed today, and I'm happy to.
Hendricks dealing.
No through 6. Swing and a miss. And it's Baez. Cardinal fans are clapping as well, and his teammates greet him very warmly. Deep, back at the wall, Braun. Game over. Cubs win.
Clinch last night. A walk-off win in 10 innings here today, and let the party begin.